One week ago, when we last convened for the Editor's Roundtable version of the Reason podcast, we had a spirited and mostly unresolved debate over whether 2018 America was veering toward an ominous future of increasing political violence. Since then, we've had a Florida man, a MAGA memer, arrested for sending pipe bombs to about a dozen high-profile Democrats. A white man killed two black people in Kentucky after failing to barge into a black church. And then most horrifically, over the weekend, an anti-Semite and anti-immigrant nutbag killed 11 people during a ceremony at the Tree of Life Congregation Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Hello, everyone. Matt Welch here, along with my colleagues Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. You guys all have your audio sorted, our jury-rigged system here?
Yes, we do.
Hi. Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning. As usual, after such horrific incidents, there are a lot of emotional debates raging around the country, everything from President Trump's possible culpability, the politics of the immigrant caravan, wars over media bias, and the role of social media site Gab in this case. But I wanted to start off more generally kind of where we left off last week, Catherine, since you were the one most hesitant about declaring our new era to be uniquely worrisome from a political violence perspective. Just going to start, have the events over the past week caused you to reconsider that at all?
You know, it's hard to say no here because it sounds churlish. It sounds insensitive. But the fact is that we are now, as a country, on like an incredible high level of alert. We are aggregating, everything bad that happens. Now, the things that have happened in this last week are incredibly bad. You didn't even get to the election in Brazil, which, while not directly related to this violence question, is certainly related to the broader "are we descending into a dystopian hellscape" question. I still think, and maybe this is at this point crazy, but I still think that this is possibly just a wiggle on the graph. I really do think that. I think that, broadly speaking, the desperate upset and high levels of coverage of these terrible events is still a symptom of a world that things are basically getting better, that we fundamentally resolve things with dialogue and not with violence. But yeah, wow, it's been a terrible week.
Nick, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, because I think I was most out front in saying that, politics has changed. And I think that that is true. I mean, I think we did not have a president who was calling, porn stars that he paid hush money to be quiet about an affair that they may have had, horse face in the past. I mean, nobody called Rachel Jackson, Andrew Jackson's bigamous wife, horse face. They might have called her worse.
Are we sure?
In public.
They definitely called her worse.
In public, and it wasn't, John Quincy Adams, or it wasn't Andrew Jackson, et cetera. I mean, the question is, are we, is the country more violent? And in fact, it is not. The crime went down, violent crime went down last year. We are still in a historically low era. I do think that political rhetoric has changed and it's become much coarser, much more violent, much more fucked up. I think we continue to see that. I mean, Trump's main comment after, the shooting happened, he said he had some calming platitudes, which was nice. And then this morning he went on a tirade at 8 a.m. about fake news and about how fake news is the real problem, et cetera. Like, there's something wrong with our political discourse. And immediately everybody, and Matt, you kind of telegraphed this, everybody on every side who has a stake, immediately a bunch of left-wing and anti-conservative writers came out saying Trump is responsible for this, Fox News is responsible for this, blah, blah, blah. And then, the right, the Weekly Standard actually did a great job of policing conservatives, where last week they ran this compendium of all of these conservatives who said that the mail bombs were obviously a false flag operation when it turned out, they had no evidence for that. But I think political rhetoric is more violent. I think it's more divisive. And I think it's a real problem because it polarizes things. It drives more decent people out of discussions. And that's a problem, because what we need is that vast center. Reason has a great piece from Maurice Fiorina talking about a couple of recent political science books. He's at Stanford and the Hoover Institution. His main insight of his entire career is that actually most Americans agree on most issues, but they can't be represented in politics or the media because the people who are most active in politics and the media are unrepresentative and hyperpolarized. And I think we're seeing that in the extreme right now.
Well, one way
I don't mean to get us down a nitpicky line here, but again, just in the service of my point, like Rachel Jackson, Andrew Jackson's wife, literally died of sorrow because of the scandals that surrounded her and the harsh rhetoric that came out of John Quincy Adams' campaign, who campaigned on Jackson's passion and lack of self-control. Newspapers under
the
aegis of his campaign
said,
"Ought a convicted adulteress and her paramour husband be placed in the highest office in this free and Christian land?" Again, it's not good then. It's not good now. It's not new.
It's always worth pointing out that the era of the Civil War was probably a little bit more heightened in terms of rhetoric when Americans were butchering one another.
Yeah, but we're not comparing it to 150 years ago. We're comparing it to 20 years ago and 10 years ago. And even when you had people like Jerry Falwell claiming that the bodies were piling up at the Mena airstrip in Arkansas of all the people that the Clintons had killed, he was on his way off the main stage. He was a crackpot. And again, I think, you know, it's worth, you know, is it worse or better than it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago? And more important, is it a problem? I think it is a problem. I think political discourse, I want to say for people who work at a place called Reason, you seem to be very comfortable with like the most fact-free, inflammatory and kind of hysterical rhetoric. Not that we're dealing in it, but, I think it would be good. A little reason is called for.
I'm not sure anyone's comfortable with fact-free rhetoric. And let's use that as a pivot to Peter here. Nick referenced Trump's tweet of this morning. He redeclared this is a tweet where the subject is about the climate of violence in this country in the wake of the Pittsburgh attack. And in that, he redeclared the fake news to be, quote, the enemy of the people, unquote. And this is the same president who also referred to the pipe bombs about a week ago as, quote, unquote, bombs. So he was contributing to that sense of what Nick was talking about. The Weekly Standard nutbaggery on the right. Is there's a common take out there, Peter, of people saying, hey, look, yes, there's a coarsening of rhetoric on both sides. There's a dehumanization of the opposition on both sides. But there appears to be a qualitative difference on the right in terms of the amount of both conspiracy mongering and rhetorical one-upsmanship and demonizing of the opposition happening right now into Trumpian conservatism. What say you, Peter?
I think that the difference is, I wouldn't necessarily describe it as, use the word qualitative difference. Instead, I would say that there's a relative difference in influence and power. And the difference is where the rhetoric is coming from. And in this case, it's coming from the president of the United States, the most powerful politician arguably in the world, the leader of the Republican Party. And so just to add to some of the stuff that Trump has said, prior to the bombings and the shootings this week, we've had all of these stories about the migrant caravan that's coming up through Mexico. And Trump has been out front making wildly false, totally evidence-free statements about how it's funded by George Soros, about how it's like a plot to sneak Muslim extremist terrorists into the United States, about how it's basically just sort of a free roaming, you know, sort of a gang of Mexican killers, and the right-wing media has parroted a lot of this, has sort of suggested that this is a thing that we should be investigating. You have had members of Congress in the Republican Party saying this. And so the difference to me that matters is is the amount of power that the people who are saying this, who are spreading these ideas have. And Trump, there's no one, certainly no one in America and arguably no one in the world who commands more political power over a larger scale than Donald Trump. And he is responsible for his rhetoric, and he is responsible for leading his party and his supporters in that rhetoric and in a lot of these just really crazy beliefs. And whether or not that's I don't think that it is fair to say that that is directly causing violence. But we can criticize the president for being quite wrong, for being violent in his own tone. It's not like violent in tone is not the right way to describe it, but
he's
aggressive and hostile,
aggressive and confrontational, but
in his own in his own tone.
Well, he is at times violent. I mean,
not in these specific cases.
Rhetoric.
He has called for
small scale interpersonal violence at his rallies for sure.
Offered to pay the legal bills,
but certainly,
and this has been part of his political persona from the beginning. And I think it's totally fair to criticize him, to criticize everyone in the Republican Party who goes along with this and who supports him. For this, even if you can say that, well, look, because there, you know, we have correlation here in that Trump is president and these acts are happening. We don't have direct causation. But you can I think you can separate those things just a little bit while still going after the president and still being quite critical of the way he talks about this stuff.
I would even go as far, because I'm a sensitive soul at heart, as we all know. If you are responding to a horrific national act of political violence, and in fact, kind of a short-term flurry of the things and a lot of emotional upset about that, if your reaction to that is to label another group of Americans as the enemy of the people,
you have disqualified
yourself for consideration for the presidency from the Matt Welch point of view. Thankfully, that point of view doesn't dominate in America, but I think
I totally agree with that.
I think Trump disqualified himself
from the presidency with his rhetoric from day one by starting his campaign as the whole problem is that Mexicans aren't sending us their best people. They're all, you know, basically rapists and drug dealers and murderers. And that has been the foundation of Trump's campaign, has been a kind of violent rhetoric, aggressive, hostile bigotry from the very beginning. And if you want a through line that connects Donald Trump's political persona, that is it. And it has been with us since he got on those steps at Trump Tower in 2015 and announced his candidacy.
Catherine, there's an interesting social media angle to this, which is, and it touches on stuff that we have chewed on this podcast in the past, which is that the Pittsburgh shooter was a guy who was on Gab. And Gab is kind of a thing that, in a sense, that we had called for on this podcast, which is the free market sorting out through examples of what happens when people get deplatformed. Now, I think Gab has itself been deplatformed, and there's a lot of people cheering that. How do you look at that from a perspective of a culture of free speech and a free speech marketplace of ideas? Are you happy that Gab is no longer publishing? Where's your brain on this?
You know, I've always been on the side of a sort of a proliferation of platforms and an absolute right of those platforms to deplatform anyone they like. I think that the kind of Matryoshka doll of deplatformery that we are now experiencing, in which, we have many layers of service providers who have choices about who they host, who they allow to comment, who they allow to have a profile on their site. We've got actually a piece going up this afternoon talking about all of the alternatives to Facebook. We wrote it before the Gab deplatforming, but I think it's increasingly relevant. I think this is the system working, right? Like to say, okay, well, we tried creating a secondary space for people who weren't welcome in the mainstream discourse. And you know what? Even there, still not tolerable to people who have a choice about whether to provide hosting and services. you know, I actually think this is the mechanism whereby if our rhetoric is increasingly harmful, we are more likely to solve it rather than A, the kind of generic calls for civility, which we hear a lot of, or B, anything that looks like legislation. At the same time, I think, you know, I get why it makes people nervous. And I think some of those people include people on this podcast, that speech might become more and more siloed and more polarized. People might live in their bubbles. You know, this, I think, is an example of why it's good to conduct our speech in private spaces, even very, very large private spaces, rather than always in public spaces, because it does allow a very subtle differentiation of who gets to say what where.
Well, this is, I think, the thing that I want to.
You don't worry
at
all, though, that when you push people out of out of the public square, that they become more and more extreme. And again,
I do worry, and I think the remedy is more platforms, right? The remedy is build a gab and then break a gab, and then build minds and then break minds. And I mean, the answer is ever more new platforms that people can move to. I think that there will always be people who have a victim complex. There will always be people who want to say that they're the underdog because they were deplatformed. That's unavoidable. But again, I would much rather have it be that people hate Jack of Twitter or Mark Zuckerberg than that they hate, you know, the government of the United States.
Peter, you're going to jump in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we want to talk about what's different than 10 or 20 years ago, it seems to me that what's obviously different is that a huge amount of our political rhetoric now takes place on social media. And if you want to talk about what the real difference is between now and 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, is the ability for anyone, but especially prominent figures like President Trump, to speak, to say anything they want without any kind of filtering, without any sort of without anything sort of in between them, in particular on Twitter, in a form that's sort of designed to highlight very punchy, kind of aggressive statements. And it really strikes me, I mean, sort of not to go, you know, totally Marshall McLuhan on here, but in some sense, Twitter has trained us all to speak in a certain way and to talk in a certain way. It has every platform, every medium incentivizes a certain kind of discourse. And I don't think it's entirely an accident that it feels, especially for those of us who are on social media all day long, which increasingly is everyone, it increasingly feels as if this sort of the rhetoric has gotten more heated, has gotten more aggressive, more hostile, as if racism and bigotry, anti-Semitism has become more common. Certainly, we're seeing it a lot more, and those people have mechanisms for connecting with both with themselves and for becoming visible to members of the media and to others. And, you know, we have a president whose presidency is basically a Twitter feed. Donald Trump is like the Donald Trump character, the Donald Trump president. Presidency, not the administration, which is a larger thing that actually includes some real sort of quasi-governance, includes the FCC and the EPA and, all of that stuff. But Donald Trump, the political figure, is almost entirely a figure, a character born out of social media and out of the ways in which people conduct themselves on social media. And what is Donald Trump like? We've been talking about that. I don't need to go into it one more time. But That's politics. That's social media politics. And I think that you can't just say that social media is having no influence here.
But you also can't say that what social media feels like is the reality. And for instance, last night, David Bernstein at the Volley Conspiracy put up a post saying, OK, is anti-Semitism up? Let's take a look. And he looked at this Anti-Defamation League study that's making the rounds and highlighted some flaws with it, and moreover, you know, put out a call for if anyone can show him basically a poll or some kind of measure of American attitudes that shows that anti-Semitism is up, and you can't. Like, this is, you know, it feels like there's a presentism bias with Twitter, and it is aggressive, and it is not totally irrational, again, because the president is a powerful person and he is a very online person, as the kids say, but the underlying beliefs of the American populace about Jews, at least, have not changed.
But the underlying beliefs are not what's in question. It's the expression of them and the connection between anti-Semites, right? So it used to be that if you were anti-Semitic, maybe you'd mutter something to your buddies at the bowling alley or, to your family at the dinner table. Now you can mutter online all day to 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 people and find all the thousands of other people who agree with you and feel like you have a community and become more intensely involved sort of in terms of it can become a bigger part of your day, of your mindset, of your personality. In a way that it just couldn't, unless you were the kind of person who went out of your way to go to Klan rallies or something like that 15 or 20 years ago. And that's what it does. It's not that it changes attitudes so much as it connects people, connects fringe attitudes together and gives them a feeling of community, gives them a feeling of purpose, and allows them to indulge in those bad ideas and those bad thoughts in a way that that they didn't beforehand. And I think you can connect this. So a big part of change the subject just a little bit to Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt's book, which talks about the sense of fragility and sort of victimhood that is now very common on college campuses. And they talk a lot about, they basically say that the biggest factor in terms of that that they can see is the presence of social media. And so kids who grew up with social media now feel this way a lot more because that is what social media does to people. It's the way that it encourages them to think and feel. It's not that it necessarily makes anti-Semitism more common. It makes it more prevalent within the lives of those people who feel it because it connects those people to other people who feel the same way. It makes it much easier to indulge in those feelings and those ideas.
But there's the serious question of, and with anti-Semitism, because a number of people who have attacked the president and said he's responsible for the synagogue shooting, they are going from the presumption that anti-Semitic acts are up, terrorism, vandalism, stuff like that. And if it isn't, that raises a serious question that I think Catherine is right to focus on. The other thing about social media, and I'm a big fan of The Coddling of the American Mind. I think it's a really important book, and I think it's in the main part true. Peter, to tie it into your kind of McLuhanite insight about Twitter, every medium teaches us and trains us to express ourselves in a way that makes most sense on that medium. Twitter is clearly doing that with a lot of public and political discourse. There's a learning curve with social media that we are in the thick of, because even though, Facebook has been around for a while, Twitter a little bit less. We still haven't figured out how to kind of best use it in the same way we saw the flip outs when rock music started. If you think of rock music as a medium of expression, people didn't quite know how to be comfortable around it or how to use it for a number of years. Same thing with cable TV. And there was this hysteria in the 90s about the surge of violence and sexuality on cable TV. We got used to it pretty quickly, and I think that'll happen with social media. And one of the things that bothers me about the way that we're talking about this stuff now is very much like Twitter, social media is the problem, et cetera. And I think what it is it's that our political institutions are falling apart, our political affiliations and identities are falling apart, and the people that are left in those categories are the most extreme, whether they're on the right or the left. And we need to figure out a way to leave them behind and actually have a good conversation that involves at least the plurality of Americans, if not a majority.
Very good. Nick, now that we have that opportunity or segue, can you please briefly hype the Soho Forum debate this week, which is completely on point of what we were just talking?
Oh, yeah, that's the West Coast Soho Forum. It's the first Oxford-style debate that we're doing on the West Coast. We sponsor the one that takes place monthly in New York City, run by Gene Epstein. And it is between Ken White of Popat and Thaddeus Russell of Renegade University. And the basic question or the proposition that is being debated is that, like universities, social media platforms should only ban people who are making truth threats or threatening violence against other users. And Thad Russell will be defending that. Ken White will be saying no. Each of them agrees that this is not a legal question. This is much more of a kind of culture, deep culture background. Do you want a culture of free and open speech in various platforms like Twitter, or do you prefer the kind of the alternative vision that Catherine has been mapping out?
Peter, you're going to say?
Nick, I agree with almost everything that you said in your monologue about political institutions breaking down. But I just say that Twitter and social media more generally is now part of our is a political institution. And it has become, for better and in my opinion, for many ways for worse, a kind of an embedded part of the way we discuss and sort of do and perform politics in this country.
But isn't it also true that for every garbage anti-Semite that finds his people on Twitter, there are exactly parallel agglomerations happening for good causes, right? I mean, I don't mean to. I feel like I've gotten myself into a place of being the Pollyanna of this podcast, which is a weird zone for me to be in. But again, like in times where a bunch of bad things happen close together, and everyone totally appropriately feels like the world is ending, I think our rhetoric about the role of social media in creating these violent incidents or in creating this uncivil climate is part of a broader conversation that can lead to bad political outcomes in terms of regulating that speech. And I just want to be really, really careful to always say, okay, but also people like us find each other and work together. And this is why I think again that the progressive ongoing deplatforming and self-sorting and opening of new platforms and closing of those new platforms is the mechanism whereby we will get to a better place.
But we're already seeing, I mean, this summer, Twitter and Facebook and Google has in other ways, they've all acknowledged that they want the government to regulate them, or they're ready for government regulation, et cetera. So I share your concerns. One of the reasons why I don't want people to scatter all over the place is that I feel like if speech is more wide open on any given platform and we have tools, I mean, for me, the whole point of Twitter, or YouTube or whatever, it's like you don't have to see anything you don't want. I mean, like you have a total control over your experience. So let people, say whatever they want on these platforms and just, curate your own experience. And that way, it's easier to keep track of or to be aware of like weird shit that's going on. I mean, how many of you, I signed up for Peach when it was around. I still don't even really understand what it was.
I don't know what it was either, but it does not sound entirely wholesome.
No, and
friend.
It was like Gab, Gab. I don't think I ever signed up for it, but it's like, I'd rather have those conversations happening somewhere on Twitter and then like people kind of following them and interacting with people around the edges to kind of have a more interesting and broad-based conversation. But the regulation of this stuff is coming, and it's similar. I mean, it's very similar to the early internet, or maybe not early internet, but in the 90s, where people were flipped out because anybody could talk about anything. We're going through that phase again. And, one of the things that is true, and this is mostly a Marxist critique of technology, of things like radio and TV, is that they always present themselves as timeless or always there and always new. And like, we don't have a history of this. We should be going back and looking at the arguments that people were having about the internet that led to the Communications Decency Act in the mid-90s, which thankfully was struck down because that would have regulated the internet effectively like a broadcast network. The only reason it passed widely with giant margins from Republicans and Democrats, they were all in favor of it. And it was just the Supreme Court that maintained any semblance of free speech on the internet.
Catherine, Nick was saying, not for the first time in his life, that we need to find a way to leave behind the dead enders who are dominating what remains of the kind of powerful political discourse in this country. I was in New Mexico following the Gary Johnson campaign over the weekend, and I was really struck by one set of numbers. They have early voting there like they do elsewhere. And the percentages of early voters there by block, 15% of Democrats had already voted so far in the election. 15% of Republicans had already voted. of the remaining people, which I think 22% of voters in New Mexico are independents, and another, you know, one or two is for third parties. Those people, 7% of those people had early voted, which strikes me not as interestingly instructive at the kind of hopelessly quixotic role of third parties. I don't know. You know, it's whatever.
Quixotic.
Thank you.
Should have gone to college, Matt.
Doubt it. I didn't want to learn how to sail. Some of us are just not sailors. But also that we are locked in this sense of fear-based political motivation. And it's kind of a bicameral fear-based motivation. And this past week, these past 2 weeks, maybe you can date it from the Kavanaugh hearings. People are that which spiked Republican voter enthusiasm for the first time in a really long time. When you have the perception that the other team is going to actively do terrible things to you soon, you and go and vote. You don't dabble around in other things. So I guess I want you to agree with me, Catherine, that it's kind of hard to get out of this cycle because you get clenched up, and this is a reason why Donald Trump is spending this morning talking about the enemy of the people. It works for him. It absolutely 100% works for him. So how do you unclench?
I am delighted that we made it this far into the podcast before you felt the need to use the word clench twice.
Yeah.
But here we are now at the clenching phase of the podcast.
Unclenching even more uncomfortable than clenching.
Well, yeah. I mean, Obama offered to unclench the fist, as I recall. So
yes.
That's a thing. Hmm. Right. I mean, so yes, of course you're right. Fear is a powerful motivator to humans. That is a true thing. At the same time, you know, I'm looking
fear
at this
Death Star.
Fear of the...
We'll keep the local...
Indeed, precisely that. But I'm looking at this Weekly Standard call out on the conservatives who waved the false flag, I guess. And one thing that I'm struck with is that it's all people who have been around forever, actually. It's Dinesh D'Souza. It's Rush Limbaugh. It's Ann Coulter. It's like these same Lou Dobbs, right? It's these same like skeletal, you know, crypt
some of them
keepers.
Are not so skeletal.
That's true. But even, you know, sometimes you can be both skeletal and sort of like larditudinous, I think. Anyway, so there's a...
I'm really glad we waited till this long to get the word larditudinous
yeah.
in here.
No, but I guess what I mean to say is like Rush Limbaugh has been turning out Republican voters on fear for longer than I have been alive. Like this is how... This is how politics works. And, you know, Hillary Clinton is, you know, I'm not both sidering, but I totally am because she is doing the same thing. And Harry Reid has always done the same thing. They will take away your abortion pills. They will take away your birth control pills. You won't even be able to look at a condom if the Republicans win. I mean, it truly is a powerful force on both sides. And, you know, this is one reason that poor Ron Bailey is always full of sadness because, you know, the message of Reason Science correspondent Ron Bailey is fundamentally one of hope. He basically says, like, actually, the world is getting better and better in lots of different ways. Don't freak out, everybody. And nobody will buy his books or read his articles. And it literally makes him sad that people don't know that everything's going to be fine.
Many people read his articles.
And they don't
They're
read
great.
It in nearly the volumes that he would like. And, you know,
many more people should, however.
People on the other side say, like, we're all going to die. Everything's bad. The end. And there's your New York Times bestseller. So yes, fear is a powerful motivator. Red team, blue team fear is the most powerful motivator of all. I think that that's one reason that we have seen among libertarians lately sort of an attempt to think about how to make a team, how to motivate team feeling. We're horrible.
A political ideology built around the dislike of teams is like, maybe we should all get
what
in.
Is the,
what
should
do
we
want?
Have t-shirt?
Agnosticism. When do we want it? Whatever. You know, it's
what,
not.
What is the way out, though? I mean, that's the issue. But then is it And I was I'm reporting out a story about declining declining confidence in institutions, et cetera, which I've written about in the past. And I was talking to one person and they were like, well, you know, the only thing that seems to transcend kind of partisan affiliation or ideological affiliation in the political space is war, which is really problematic. You know, and it's true that, like, you know, people were really into invading Afghanistan and people were really into invading Iraq. I mean, the Iraq vote in 2003, the invasion, that had a higher backing by Congress than the first Gulf War. You know, back in the 90s, it's you know, so there's war, but then what are the other types of, whether it's a project or is it individuals, like what are the ways to rally that gets us past like a politics of fear and kind of like ultra tribalism?
I think the answer is commerce, right? I mean, the answer is like an exciting project that isn't based on zero sum world, and that always means commerce.
Nick, you recently spoke to Francis Fukuyama and asked some of these same questions, and what he said was, you know, that one of the reasons that trust in government and kind of national political unity in the aftermath of World War II was so high was because Americans had just seen that governments, by their sort of seen some evidence that government works really well at scale, winning World War II and also undertaking a bunch of very large public works infrastructure projects. I sometimes wonder, and there is a strain of conventional wisdom amongst a certain type of political strategist that basically says that Trump could have avoided almost all of these problems, sort of the partisan division, if he'd basically started out with a $1 zillion infrastructure bill and said, "This is what we're going to do. We're going to build stuff, and we're going to create jobs." And you know, maybe it would have been a bad bill that would have spent a bunch of money that we didn't need to spend.
Maybe.
But
I don't like where you're winding yourself up to here, Suderman. Carefully before you step off this cliff.
Maybe it would have distracted from some of the other bad things, and maybe there's a trade-off here.
Really? We're going with maybe if every week were infrastructure week, we wouldn't have...
Every week is infrastructure week.
Synagogues getting shot up?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying...
I know, it's not what I'm saying. Sorry, that was unfair.
I'm not saying
what you're saying
at all. But what I'm saying is that the kind of... the partisan rancor that has defined the Trump era might have been somewhat mitigated if he had done that rather than the tax bill that nobody amazingly the tax cuts maybe not totally amazingly but it is a little bit like even surprising to me how totally ineffective politically the tax bill has turned out to be.
Yeah, it's like the only major tax cut that is actually unpopular, has like less than 50% approval.
And I, of course, have like a lot of criticisms of that bill, but like even still, I'm a little bit surprised.
It's still surprising that people just aren't.
You know, let's take it back to Obama as well, because Obama could have done something different. You know, the one thing, and I actually a number of people on the left said that he's fucked up by going whole hog on healthcare rather than on either stimulus spending, which again is bullshit. It doesn't work. But Obama was like hyper partisan, and Obama had a Democratic Congress, and he shoved, you know, the only major act of entitlement legislation that was passed on a straight party line. So it's
I spent 8 years writing about what a bad idea it was.
Yeah,
and how
it's
there's very good political science research that suggesting that Democrats lost the House in 2010 exclusively because of if they hadn't done Obamacare, that they would have retained control of the House. And what's even more sort of notable here in 2018 is that Obamacare is now popular. Obamacare as quote unquote sabotaged by Republicans, the sabotage, which, of course, has led to no change in the uninsured rate and basically flatlined, if not actually reduced, health insurance premiums and more insurers coming back into the exchanges, that kind of sabotage. It is sort of amazing that like the Republican repeal effort failed. But the one thing, the one domestic policy achievement that they have is that they have made Obamacare popular.
Dun, dun, dun. Congratulations.
I think it's, you know, it's important to recognize that Trump is as much the effect as the cause of any of this. And that's why I bring up Obama. But also before that, and Matt, in the Declaration of Independence, we wrote about,
bingo,
you know, this era. No, but of like, I mean, in the 21st century, we've seen more changes in the White House and the Senate and the Congress, you know, in Congress, than we had for decades before that. And it is calling back to Morris Fiorina, who talks a lot about the current time as similar to what political scientists called the era of no decision in the late 19th and early 20th century, where control of the White House and Congress kept going back and forth between the two parties because they were played out, whatever their identities were in the post-Civil War era. And then what happens is that a stability comes when like a new governing philosophy or framework takes over. And in the early 20th century, it was progressivism, which ultimately won both parties. And then there was more of a stability going forward after a certain point. And I think this is, you know, and obviously this is a libertarian podcast. Reason is literally celebrating its 50th anniversary next Saturday. We need to, this is the moment. Like Matt, I think our big problem was that we published the Declaration of Independence in 2011 and 2012 rather than now, because it is a model that goes forward because it allows Catherine for that commerce. Like a couple of people have told me that, you know, the Elon Musk rocket launch that was visible was one of the moments where they felt like they could forget politics for a few minutes. And, you know, and it's kind of an interesting idea, like where it's an Earth-based project, you know, to escape Earth. It unites all sorts of people, and it's non-governmental, but it's also a source of kind of transcendence and pride. And I think the libertarian message of reducing government to a manageable size and trying to improve its efficiency in the few things that it does so it does them well, I think that's where the plurality of independents are moving.
You know, it always makes me nervous when Fukuyama like takes refuge in national identity or some kind of unified thing like that, for obvious reasons, makes me feel itchy. But, you know, I do.
Unclenched.
but I do think that, you know, if I were forced to build a Fukuyama like theory, but put something else in the place of nationalism, the thing that I would say is having a frontier. And I think that's what the Musk stuff is about. I think to some extent in the 90s, that was what I think the frontier of the internet arguably created that feeling of possibility. I think that your fights feel lower stakes and less zero sum when it feels like there is more out there. And, you know, this is actually something that Tocqueville wrote about when he visited America, and he talks about fathers and sons being able to relate as equals and like being able to take each other's advice and work together profitably on the frontier, unlike in Europe, because in Europe, all the land was already allocated and you were, as a son, you were totally reliant on whatever your father gave you for your fortune in life. In the United States or in America, the son could just be like, later, Dad, I'm going out to the frontier to get my own thing. And I think having a frontier is a way to reduce the ferocity and zero-sum anger of politics and of everything in a way that I think nationalism doesn't do that. Or when it does do that, it just expands the zero-sum fighting to a global scale.
I'm totally sold. We don't need to build patriotic bridges. We need Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos to take us to Mars.
But even Elon Musk is politicized now, right? Like there's a whole situation going where like Elon Musk is slowly turning into a supervillain. I mean, he always sort of was, but he was like a cool supervillain you were secretly rooting for, and now maybe he's like a bad degenerate supervillain. I hope not. I think
agree
he's gonna pull it back.
He is a whole situation.
I just hope that when he asked for the dankest memes that people could send him, that none of them flipped him into a Pepe the Frog 2.0 guy.
The dankest meme is the gif of him smoking pot on that podcast.
Yes. It's we now live in a sort of a recursive hall of mirrors of dank memes in which Musk stares back at himself.
Like, do you think that like somewhere at like some much higher level of reality, there's like the original Elon Musk who programmed all of this,
yeah,
just to see.
Definitely, oh, all living in an Elon Musk like pot-induced simulation, and he's now just testing us by bringing that reality to the forefront in our face.
See, that's the frontier, the next level of simulated reality, and to get out
you
of this
You open
one.
His head, that's, and it's just a it's family
Westworld.
Of possums.
Stop talking so sweet to me, Peter.
It's
that's
Westworld.
All I want. All I want is for this to turn out to be Westworld.
Before we drop the topic of nationalism altogether, and you might
can I just interject real quick? Yeah. Fukuyama is clearly wrong about that, by the way, because it's not like, oh, it was great, government was really effective at winning World War II. It's like government was really effective at creating the conditions for World War II, and then we lived in fear of government and nationalism in the Soviet Union for the next 50 years. His calls in his book, I think, which are frankly disturbing, to, you know, revivify the fact that we're a creedal nation, which is good. Yeah, we're based on ideas about individualism and tolerance and freedom. That's all good. But we need national service, because that'll create a national identity that saves us from ever more fragmented sub-identities. That is not going to happen, nor should it. I'm much more interested in the way Catherine talked about a kind of a figurative frontier or a commercial frontier and projects that people voluntarily create. I mean, you know, and maybe we need to be talking about stuff that we already take for granted, like Wikipedia and whatnot. And I know, Catherine, it's got to be almost 15 years ago that you wrote a story about Wikipedia. But like stuff like that, stuff like Amazon, stuff like Tesla, all of these things have problems with them. But like there are these incredible communal undertakings, and particularly something like Wikipedia, that have just like vastly expanded and increased everything that we can do with ease. It's we need to regain a sense of wonder in what we're making.
On the topic of kind of making a libertarian pitch out there, I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of months hanging out with Libertarian Party people, and it's been interesting to watch the standard bearers of 2016, Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, kind of move off of their pitch of libertarianism as centrism in 2016. They kept talking about how there's a six-lane highway down the middle of the road in American politics, and we're driving right through it. Come on and join. Arguably, there's now an eight-lane or a 10-lane highway there on one sense. But they, both of them in different ways, have moved away from that. Johnson, his big selling pitch right now is a bit fear-based. It's a pitch to young people, where he will say, and he said this a lot during their debate that they had there on Friday, the last of the two senatorial debates. Young people, you are so screwed. You are totally screwed. He said that about 17 times. And then in an interview, which we'll have up later, he admitted that what he wanted to say and that he had to be talked out of saying by his campaign staff is that at the debate is that you're so fucked. and the argument is the service on the debt is going to be, you know, $1 trillion in 5 years, or it could be if interest rates go up by a percentage or a point or more, and it's going to crowd out all spending, and a recession is going to hit at some point soon. All the balls are going to come tumbling down. It's a really bad situation, particularly for young people. So there's that one kind of fear-based thing, and then Weld is more just kind of rejecting that altogether and making the case that there is a separate libertarian identity. It's not centrist. It outflanks on either side, depending on issue, something else. And so it's more of an appeal for, hey, look, there's just a different way of thinking about stuff, and it's this. And Weld is moving more in that direction, which I think is kind of interesting. I also wanted to
Do you mean that, but are we talking about centrism or are we talking about moderate? They were trying to be too moderate, like, you know, we're sensible, we're this, you know, which is true. But it is centrist in the sense that, you know, it's, I don't think libertarianism, like, you know, limited government and maximum, you know, like maximizing individual rights, is, it's radical, but it's actually in the center of the political spectrum at this point.
I don't see in spectrums, Nick. I see in galaxy brains.
You see in race and religion only.
yes, especially when I'm hanging out with Camille Foster. It's the only way to do it. Before I forget, a point that crossed my brain path here. In the previous conversation, is when I think Peter or Nick were talking, or no, it was Catherine talking about all of the these characters that have been their desiccated corpses have been haunting us for the last 25 years. And seriously, look at Lou Dobbs next time. Look at the close up on his face. I'm not sure that the makeup professionals over there are even touching him anymore. It's just this weird gray bag. How many of those people in 1996? Was that the year, or maybe it was a little bit before, but in the wake of the Oklahoma bombing, how many of those people righteously criticized Bill Clinton? Because if you recall, Bill Clinton, in the wake of that, used that as an opportunity to slur the entire conservative media ecosystem, laying partial or somewhat blame, on Rush Limbaugh for what had happened there, which was unfair at the time. Those people... many of them, like this is a grievance that they've held for 20 years on that moment. It was an ugly thing. We've written about it at Reason. How many of those people are standing up and agreeing with the president for, in the wake of the Pittsburgh thing, and also the pipe bomb sent to media out there, are hysterically applauding and agreeing with the idea that fake news is the enemy of the people? It'd be a fun little chart to make. Let's pivot from there to our closing of show cultural what the hell are you reading and watching and viewing and these kind of things. Nick, let's start with you.
Well, I was watching the World Series and rooting against the Red Sox because I love my country. But the World Series is over, Matt. And as we were saying before the show started, it was a good series, but it was too short. Even as the games themselves might have been too long, but it's.
Last night I was watching, I'm a baseball fanatic and enjoy watching the World Series. They have now on the Fox broadcast in-inning ads. It's not even like when they're going to the bullpen or something. There's a break in the action. It's like it's a 3-2 count, and let's pause for a moment to bring you the latest from Taco Bell. It drove me insane, and so I tweeted last night because it's late night Twitter, and I can tweet about baseball if I damn well please. That Fox should be stripped of its MLB contract. And it got picked up and passed around. And within 10 minutes, people assumed that this was because Fox News was contributing to the shoot up of the synagogue in Pittsburgh.
I would like to see maybe Megyn Kelly can become a baseball analyst at Fox.
Jesus, this is the last
too
place.
Soon.
It's way too soon. Suderman, what are you consuming?
So speaking of the virtual frontier, I spent most of the weekend playing Red Dead Redemption 2, which is really a kind of incredible, huge accomplishment as just in terms of the scale and scope of it. I'll have more to say about that later. But since it's Halloween, I also wanted to point people to the Netflix series, The Haunting of Hill House, which is really great. I'm about 7 episodes through the 10-episode season. I actually was I almost quit after the 2nd episode, and I'm glad I didn't. The 6th episode might be the single best episode of television I've seen this year. And what the show really does well is kind of transfer a lot of modern movie, sort of low and mid-budget movie horror tropes. The kind of not so much the jump scares, but just sort of the creeping sort of psychologically like sort of disturbing imagery, and then applies it to what is really just a kind of a domestic drama about a family and their problems. Somebody compared it, I think this to The Conjuring meets This Is Us, and it's like that, except good.
Is that a Shirley Jackson?
Yeah, I mean, that's according to the great and terrible Stephen King nonfiction Danse Macabre. The Haunting of Hill House is arguably the first exercise in American horror. So it's kind of interesting to put that on as a way to look at.
That seems a little ahistorical, given that. Looks like Wieland and Arthur Mervyn, but.
At any rate,
I was going to say, in Shirley Jackson, her most famous story is The Lottery. Is The Lottery a regressive tax on the poor?
I don't know.
I think it's just basically The Hunger Games, right? Like,
The Hunger Games is basically The Lottery.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Is like it's the Hunger Games.
The
Hunger Games is the lottery meets battle royale.
Catherine,
I want to recommend a podcast which I actually may have talked about on here before, but I just want to repeat my recommendation, which is Song Exploder. It's one of the best podcasts. It is not political at all. There are zero politics in this podcast, which you know, maybe you want just an idea. It is a unique in form in that it there is a single artist usually talking about a single song or a single album, and while there is a host, he then removes himself almost entirely from the conversation. So what you get is someone talking you through how they made one of their best songs or one of their most famous songs. The Rishikesh Sherway, who's the host, gets really, really good people. This week's is John Carpenter talking about writing the theme for the film Halloween, in case you want to get...
The original or the recent? Because Carpenter did also his major sort of direct involvement in the new one was writing the score again.
He talks about both, but the original score is in there too. And it's just like, it's so good. It's so interesting. You learn things you did not know before. As y'all know, my soul is empty and black and frozen, and so I barely like music at all. But this is a way to make music into words that are interesting to my brain, and I love it, and you would too.
That's great. Thank you for the non-political recommendation. And my recommendation is 1,000% political in that it's the it's where I was. The aforementioned debate, New Mexico Senate debate featuring a Democratic incumbent Martin Heinrich, Republican weirdo outsider Mick Rich, and Libertarian. Seriously, watch it. You will not disagree. And Gary Johnson. It was absurdly entertaining, and it makes you long for a world in which it's normal to have libertarians on stage in the debate. Not just because it was Gary Johnson, who you don't necessarily equate with entertaining on a given basis, but he certainly was in this case. But just having the libertarian element there on stage makes for moments that you wouldn't otherwise get. I'm reminded of the 2008 Republican presidential debate, or no, 2012, an early one that featured both Gary Johnson back when he was a Republican and Ron Paul. They spent like 10 minutes talking about legalizing heroin. It's like when libertarians are around, you're going to have weird conversations. And in this case, the moderator, who is a kind of funny journalist, asked everyone, when's the last time you smoked pot? which is a question that's just not going to come up. Let's be honest, that's not going to come up if it's not there. What's great is that the senator from New Mexico, Martin Heinrich, who's just like this bland Martin O'Malley Democrat, is just like, I look like a senator, so here I am. He couldn't handle the question. He's like,
seems like you should be ready for that when you're running against Garjo.
He immediately acknowledged that he had, and when pressed on when was the last time, because of course that comes up, like, did you smoke pot while you were in office, dude? His answer was, well, kind of. I mean, the whole point about pot is that you don't really remember it. So it's great. Look on YouTube for it, and maybe I'll throw up a link somewhere in a post later on this week. But it was hugely entertaining to see that happen. And that's all the entertainment we have time for on this week's Editor's Roundtable version of the Reason podcast, which you can subscribe to over on iTunes. Rate and review us and all that. And stay tuned all week as we provide phenomenal Reason podcast content. Goodbye.